This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Lou Daly, Senior Fellow at Demos, the New York City progressive think tank. A writer on religion, political development, and economic thought, Lou's books include Godless Economy and God and the Welfare State. Lou Daly is here today to tell us about his book, co-authored with Gar Alperovitz, titled Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance and Why We Should Take It Back, published in November 2008 by The New Press. Welcome, Lou.
It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you. What led you to write your book, Unjust Deserts?
The problem of growing inequality in America is sort of the starting point for the research that we did in the book. Many of your listeners probably know the basic trends in that regard, but just to give people a snapshot of what we're talking about when we talk about growing inequality, if you take just the wealth, we'll leave aside the conditions of our wage structure. If you take the wealth, which is really the most important part of our economy because that's the assets, that's what gives people a foothold in the appreciating value of our economy, in our progress as a nation. So the assets are actually much more unequal than the wages and have always been so historically, but increasingly so today. So if you take the total assets of our economy in the private economy, I think this is for the year 2004, about $30 trillion in assets out there. The top 5% of households has about $13.6 trillion out of those $30 trillion in assets. The bottom 90%, basically almost all of the rest of society, has about $13.9 trillion in assets. So essentially, the very richest Americans have as much wealth, as basically the entire rest of our society. And if you actually look at the bottom half of the population, 150 million people, and those are the people who we want to have assets because that gives them upward mobility, they only have about $1.9 trillion out of the 30, which is less than 6%. So 50% has only 6%. 5% has basically 50%. So that's the sort of the context for our book. How do we think about growing inequality, growing disparity of assets, and how do we challenge it?
In your book, you make the contention that much of our individual success is due to the culture we have inherited as opposed to individual effort. Before we go into more detail, would you give a brief overview as to why this is the case?
Well, Warren Buffett, who I think we can assume knows something about wealth and how we make wealth, once said when asked about I think he was being asked about why the estate tax is important, because he's a supporter of the estate tax. And he said, well, because society is responsible for a significant percentage of what I am worth. In other words, society has contributed a lot to enable him to generate the value that he's generated with his investing strategies. And so reciprocally, it's only natural to think on a very simple moral principle that you owe something back for what you've been given. And so what we do is to take that principle, which really goes back to the Gospel of Luke. In my mind, I'm a scholar of religion, and that's part of what has shaped our thinking in this book. In the Gospel of Luke, it's famously said, to whom much is given, from him much will be expected. That's what Warren Buffett is saying about his wealth, and that's what we talk about and focus on in the context of our economy today, which we argue is, at its core, a knowledge-driven economy. And so what we do is take the data that's showing our shift to a knowledge basis for our assets, and then we ask ourselves, well, where does knowledge come from? If knowledge is driving our growth, if knowledge is the source of our income generation today in the knowledge economy, the question you have to ask is, where does knowledge come from? Because it's only then that you can begin to talk about and think about, well, who deserves to benefit from it? Who deserves what? Where the knowledge comes from determines who deserves to benefit, again, on a very traditional moral principle.
Could you go into more detail about to what extent the inherited knowledge that accumulates across generations contributes to wealth accumulation?
Well, I think the best way of getting into that is to look at our economic growth and how our economic growth breaks down in terms of the sources of growth. And the most important research in that area for those who are interested is by an MIT economist named Robert Solow, who in the 1950s developed a new, what was called a growth model, that could be used to pretty precisely calculate what are the sources of growth. Because if you know the sources of growth, then you're able to develop policies to help facilitate more growth and more broadly shared prosperity. So that was sort of the point of the research that he was doing in the 1950s. And what he discovered when he applied his new model to the data of the 1950s in terms of inputs into the economy, the sources of the wealth relative to our growth, our output, he found a very surprising thing, and it was quite shocking within the economic field, that capital, meaning more machines, more factories, what employers supply when they invest in things, was only responsible for about 12% of our growth over the first half of the 20th century. Now, conventionally, it was thought that capital accumulation was the most important thing, and therefore employers, when they invest in machines, and that's why they're justified in getting such big rewards compared to workers, because the capital is really the source of the wealth. Actually, it was only 13% of our growth. And the 88% that was left, and it was famously called the solo residual, because it was basically left over once you accounted for capital. All that was left over was 88%. And Robert Solow argued at the time that the only way to characterize this residual is to describe it as our inherited technological capacity. And so we put a number on the technological inheritance of 88% of our wealth is coming from that. And then we take that number and then try to break it down into what are the different dimensions of that inheritance.
Technological progress has often been credited to individuals who make important breakthroughs. What is your view of the role of individuals in technological progress?
Well, one of the bodies of evidence, so we have the 88% number of wealth that's coming from technological inheritance. What other kinds of evidence, sort of in the real world, do we have of this? And one of the main bodies of evidence is the history of technology. The problem is that sort of in popular education, my daughter came home with a little reading assignment about Alexander Graham Bell recently, so I was reminded of this. Kids are taught, and generally in popular debate, we're taught a heroic view of technological progress, which is basically, you know, our progress is a sequence of great inventions and great discoveries by great individuals without whom we wouldn't have any progress. But in fact, in the actual study of technology, what you see is not a sequence of great breakthroughs, but a slow accumulation of knowledge where each new advance is really usually nothing more than recombining existing knowledge in new ways. So the existing knowledge is just as important as the quote-unquote inventor who's altering it just a little bit to move forward. One of the key trends that you can look at to really understand this is what's called simultaneous invention. Simultaneous invention is basically a situation where one or more, or often dozens of people, invent or discover the same thing at roughly the same time, but working independently of each other. So the most famous example of this, I mentioned Alexander Graham Bell, is in fact the telephone. In 1876, when Alexander Graham Bell, or his lawyer rather, filed for his patent on the telephone in New York City, that very day, another man, Elisha Gray, an educator from Ohio, trekked all the way to New York, got to the patent office 4 hours later, but filed a patent on essentially the same device. They were working independently of each other. 4 years earlier, another man named Antonio Meucci, who was an Italian immigrant and a stage technician, a very interesting guy, He actually had the same device all drawn up, in fact, a better version of it, but didn't have the $10 in his pocket to file for the patent. So what this tells me is that, in a sense, Alexander Graham Bell is not the inventor of the telephone. He is the person who won the race to get the legal control of the telephone as an invention. That, to me, isn't as heroic as, you know, many of us would like to think. What it tells me is that the individuals, and I know this sounds troubling, but the individuals are, in a sense, substitutable with one another. If you took Alexander Graham Bell out of the picture, if he had never been born, we would still have had a telephone. Elisha Gray would have had the title to it, or Antonio Meucci would have had the title to it. But the most important thing is that we would have had it with or without any of the people who end up getting all the credit and all the money, and that doesn't seem right.
I'm Diane Horn, and we were speaking with Lou Daly, Senior Fellow at Demos and co-author with Gar Alperovitz of the book Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance and Why We Should Take It Back. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Well, you spoke earlier about the importance of knowledge in wealth accumulation. Would you comment also on the role that government or public money has played in the production of private wealth?
We could have written a whole book on that. That's in one of our chapters. And in a sense, we say, well, as much as government contributes, this is actually just a small part of the inheritance, but it's very important. And it's the one that's most directly relevant in terms of policy. It's the one that we can fix, so to speak, most easily. So a very basic body of evidence is our computing power today. The information revolution would not have happened or would have been delayed by decades were it not for the research investments and the contracts from the government, which created a market for computer developments like solid-state circuitry. Without that market, there would have been no incentive in the private economy to develop solid-state circuitry. The Apollo project basically launched our revolution of microcomputing power in the form of silicon microchips. 18 of the 25 most important, according to one study, developments in computing since World War II were financed and developed by government. The most famous of which, probably the most important of which, is the Internet, which began its life in the 1960s as a Defense Department project having to do with the Cold War and having a distributed communications system so that a nuclear attack wouldn't be able to knock out our communications capacity in a single blow. That was the motivation for the kind of distributed network that we now know as the Internet. And for 30 years, government carried that along into the early 1990s. In the 1980s, it was taken over, if you will, by universities. Many of us will remember kind of the big mainframe computers that we were able to use in universities in the 1980s. But it wasn't until the early 1990s, after 30 years of development, that the Internet had reached a point where it became a marketable commodity. And it was by legislation. It was privatized at that point. But we would think of where we would be without that 30 years of development. We wouldn't have had that information boom in the 1990s. And think of where we would be in the context of our current downturn without that productivity. And you begin to recognize how important the public sector is.
Given that we have a collective inheritance that comes from our knowledge and also to some extent from the government and public money, then from an ethical point of view, who deserves to benefit?
The basic principle, the basic ethic of our book is that wealth that is generated by common assets should be equally shared, if not perfectly equally, that's impossible, more equally shared than they are today. So that's the principle, that if something is collectively created, we all should enjoy the benefits of it collectively in some way, not necessarily the abolition of private ownership or the social ownership of all of the wealth, maybe in a compensatory way, that those who don't have good access to the wealth of knowledge, if you will, should be compensated in other ways to help them and to bring them up to a level of dignity in our society. For us, that's the only way in which we can have a fair society. But what you really have to understand to get to that point and to be able to justify the kinds of redistribution that we need for everyone to live in dignity, you really have to understand the extent to which our economy has become highly socialized, has become so dependent on collective assets, because that then becomes the basis for thinking about a more broadly shared prosperity. If you don't understand the collective assets, there's no way to morally justify a more broadly shared prosperity. And so those are the pieces of our argument.
What proportion of an individual's earnings should accrue to society rather than to the individual?
Well, to go back to Robert Solow's number of 88%, in a very strict moral sense, 88% of our GDP, meaning our national income, 88% of individual holdings of that national income is what we describe as the morally available surplus, the part of our economy that's generated by common assets. Now, in fact, in the 1950s and the 1960s, which was in fact the time when our economy was most productive and the middle class was enjoying most of the gains of our growth, the top marginal tax rate in our tax code on the wealthiest Americans was 91% throughout that whole period. Now it's about 36%. So moving back in that direction, not all the way back to 90%, because that would cause upheavals in terms of people sending their savings overseas and moving out of the country because the wealthy are so accustomed to much lower tax rates. But moving back in that direction, you know, is clearly morally justified. We're clearly capable of doing that in terms of important questions of incentives and efficiency. You don't want to redistribute the wealth to such a degree that you shut down the economy and take away people's incentives to work. But we think there's a lot more room between our current levels of taxation and that 90% morally available surplus to do that.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lou Daly, Senior Fellow at Demos and co-author with Gar Alperovitz of the book Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance and Why We Should Take It Back. Would you comment on earned versus unearned income and the idea that wealth created by circumstances should be claimed for social purposes?
Theodore Roosevelt famously said that recapturing unearned income for the benefit of society, I'm paraphrasing, is the central condition of progress. He was very acutely aware of what we're talking about here. In many ways, it's a very conservative argument. It's the idea that you can't have a moral basis of individualism if you're allowing individuals to capture socially created wealth, because that undermines the principle of individualism. So many people within the liberal tradition, not socialism, but liberalism, David Ricardo, Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, Theodore Roosevelt, and in a more cogent way, I think Franklin Roosevelt, all well within the tradition of American liberalism, looked at this question of social assets generating our wealth as really a question of unearned income, of people unfairly capturing the product of society for their individual benefit. And so there's a whole legacy of thinking and policy even attempting to capture the unearned income, the individual wealth that society created. And we go through that in part two of the book. And for people interested in moral philosophy and ethical thinking about wealth, that part of our book, part two, will be very interesting.
You've alluded to this already, but what do the insights presented in your book suggest for public policy?
Well, the first thing we would do, to be very specific, is to look at the top 2% of households. That's about 2 million people with an average household wealth of about $1 million of worth. And we would say, okay, we don't have equal access to education in America today. You've benefited a lot from our knowledge inheritance, largely a part of our educational systems. You've benefited much more than everyone else. And some people don't have access to it at all. We think you owe something back to reciprocate for all of the knowledge that educational systems created and that have enabled you to have such wealth. So we will levy your wealth as a knowledge inheritance surcharge of 2% annually, which would leave them with, if I'm right, well over $950,000 of wealth. And that generates $40 billion annually of income revenue that we would put in an endowment, a public endowment that would do grant making for tuition. And eventually, as the endowment grows, that endowment will be able to give enough grants so that students won't have to take out loans anymore to go to college. Because loans are becoming increasingly onerous. Students are graduating with about $20,000 worth of debt on average every year. And so you go into this kind of job market with that kind of debt, that college degree isn't worth as much as it used to be. If you replace those loans with grants, that to us is a better form of access to our knowledge inheritance, which we think all members of society deserve.
Are there additional public policy steps you would suggest?
Well, I do think that we have to rethink our tax structure and move somewhat back in a more progressive direction, not to the levels of the 1990s, but perhaps to the levels of the 1970s, because we have social challenges out there and fiscal inability to deal with those challenges because of revenue shrinkage. And so we need to find ways to generate more revenue. And I think on the analysis of our book, one of the ways to do that is to move back toward a more progressive tax structure where the wealthier households are paying a larger share of their income back into society to reciprocate from their societal benefits. The other thing I think we would do is to help promote employee ownership, because that isn't sort of an after-the-fact compensation for inequality. That actually gives the average person and their households a stake in the assets, in the wealth, which is ultimately what we're talking about. And so there are legislative changes that can be made to help facilitate the development of employee ownership, which is in fact an increasingly important part of our economy. There are more workers today who work in employee-owned firms than there are workers in trade unions today, a little known fact. So we're already moving in the direction of kind of an asset-based approach to redistribution in the form of employee ownership, and we'd want to push that further.
What would you say to those who argue that if income is redistributed, the economy will be hurt as there will be less incentive to work?
It's not true. In fact, when our economy was most productive, when we had the highest growth rates, and when the middle class was benefiting most, as I mentioned, the top marginal tax rate was 90%. When Bill Clinton came into office in the early 1990s, one of the first things he did was raise the top marginal tax rate, I think, to about 39%. It had dropped down to about 35% during the Reagan years. And there was tons of reports from the Cato Institute and various other conservative think tanks. Oh, the economy is going to collapse. You know, once you set expectations of 35%, if you raise it to 39, people are just going to leave the country. It's so awful. The sky is falling just by moving up that top rate 4%. And in fact, if we remember the 1990s, that was the starting point of a major economic boom. And it was the last time that wages were rising in America and the last time we actually had a surplus in our federal budget. So far from making the economy collapse, arguably, if you have a more progressive tax structure where you have adequate revenues to be able to reinvest in the workforce through better access to education, for example, you end up with better prospects for long-term growth.
What kind of response are you getting to your book and to your ideas?
Mostly positive. A lot of what we're saying, despite the fact that it sounds kind of socialistic, actually, when you look at it closely, even a little bit closely, actually makes a lot of sense. And I think one thing that I found very interesting about the recent presidential campaign, you remember when we had the financial bailout and when former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson put out his three-page plan, which eventually became the TARP plan, and there was just outrage over it, you know, because it was basically a blank check to help the bankers on Wall Street. And the debate kind of shifted into Congress, and the representative mechanisms kicked into gear, and public opinion was strongly voiced along these lines, that if we are going to bail out Wall Street to save the financial system, then we, the taxpayers, society, are going to have some kind of ownership stake in those assets when they get turned around and start growing in value again. That's the same principle of our book. From society's contribution, there is established a principle of society getting a return for what it contributes. And that became commonly debated, common wisdom in our politics just last fall. Now, we take that principle and go much further with it and go really to the heart of our whole economic growth by focusing on knowledge. But essentially, you know, it's the same principle that we heard so loudly and clearly last fall.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I go back to the two fundamental points. One, that our wealth is increasingly generated by common assets. And two, that has moral implications. Wealth that is generated collectively should be shared, if not perfectly equally, more equally than it is today. And that's basically from point A to point B, that's basically what we're talking about in our book.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Lou.
It was great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We have just been speaking with Lou Daly, Senior Fellow at Demos and author with Gar Alperovitz of the book Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance and Why We Should Take It Back. For more information, check on the web at www.unjustdeserts.com. Again, that's unjustdeserts.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.